Good evening and welcome to the Michigan Writer Series. It's nice to see familiar faces. My name is Stephanie Mattson and I'm the publicity coordinator among other hats I wear around here. And I assist Peter Berg, the head of our Special Collections Library, with coordinating these events. Tonight I'm pleased to introduce to you novelist Jamie Gordon. Jamie was born and raised in Baltimore, the city that provides the setting for much of her work. She received her BA from Antioch College and went on to earn graduate degrees from Brown University. Gordon now resides in Kalamazoo, where she teaches in the Creative Writing MFA and PhD program at Western Michigan University. Her first novel, Champ of the City Solo, was published in 1974 and became an underground fantasy classic, establishing her reputation for, quote, stylistic exuberance, linguistic innovation, and fearless experimentation along the boundaries of both genre and gender, unquote. There followed the novel, or novella, rather, Circumspections from an Equestrian Statue about Civil War General Ambrose Burnside, and a book-length narrative poem, The Bend, the Lip, the Kid, Real-Life Stories. Gordon's second novel, She Drove Without Stopping, appeared in 1990 to considerable acclaim. After its publication, Jamie received an Academy Institute Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. She has won grants from the Literature Program of the National Endowment for the Arts, as well as the Michigan Arts Foundation. In addition, Jamie has been a fellow of the Fine Arts Work Center Provincetown and the Bunting Institute of Radcliffe College. Jamie's most recently published novel, Boogie Woman, is at once, quote, funny, iconoclastic, and bittersweet, and it offers us a prose so lavish and daring that it achieves nothing less than a radicalization of language, unquote. Gordon's stories have been published in Michigan Quarterly Review, Plowshares, the Missouri Review, Shank Painter, and many other journals. A fan of the track, Gordon's short story about horse racing, A Night's Work, was included in Best American Short Stories 1995. And her novel in progress, Lord of Misrule, is also about life at the racetrack. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me in welcoming Jamie Gordon.
Thank you. I am going to read a story which is smuggled out of the novel, the racetrack novel that I'm still working on. And it's long. I want to warn you, it's less than an hour. I'm not sure exactly how long it's going to be, between 50 minutes and 55, I think. So I won't waste too much time giving you an introduction to it. But I thank you very much for being an audience for it. It's really important to me to hear this work out loud one time and to see whether I can do a plausible job of reading this particular point of view of the novel. The novel works from four different points of view. One is a young woman who's not very experienced around the track. One is a horse trainer, very daring, very adept, but a gambler and a little bit sadistic, who is slowly crumbling under the stress of the track, so that he's frankly psychotic by the end of the book. Another person is one of the main characters from the story, A Night's Work, a racetrack financier, as he calls himself. He's actually a loan shark named Tutai Samuels, based on my Uncle Willie. And he is never on the racetrack, always nearby, because he's long since been ruled off for his unsavory associations. And the fourth character is an old-time black groom named Medicine Ed, and it's his point of view that I'm going to be reading from tonight. As you may imagine, I feel that there's a certain amount of presumption in my working from this point of view, but at the same time, this was the kind of character that I knew when I worked on the racetrack in my early 20s and that really made this book worth writing for me in the first place. If I couldn't do this point of view, then the book's not worth doing at all. So this is Medicine Ed's entry into the novel, and the story is called Mr. Bullweevil. It starts with a little epigraph from Ainsley's Complete Guide to Thoroughbred Racing. In five lines, you have to learn what a claiming race is, or you won't understand this story. By the way, the story is for my friend Bubbles Riley. He's an old-time groom himself. When he enters his animal in a race for $5,000 claiming horses, the owner literally puts it up for sale at that price. Any other owner can file a claim before the race and lead the beast away after the running. The original owner collects the horse's share of the purse if it earned any, but he loses the horse at a fair price. That is, he loses the horse at a fair price if it is a $5,000 horse. Ainsley's Complete Guide to Thoroughbred Racing. Inside the back gate of the backside of Indian Mound Downs, a hot walking machine creaked round and round. In the judgment of Medicine Ed walking a horse himself around the shed row of Barn Z, the going nowhere contraption must be the lost soul of this cheap racetrack where he had ended up at. It was stuck there in the gate so you couldn't get out. It filled up the whole road between a hill of horse manure against the backside fence, stubbled with pale, dirty straw like a penitentiary haircut, and a long red puddle in the red dirt, a puddle that was almost a pond. Right down to the sewer horses at each point of the Silver Star, it resembled some woe-begone carnival ride, some skeleton of a two-bit ride dreamed up by a dreamer too tired to dream. There'd been no rain all August, and by now the fresh-worked horses were half lost in the pink cloud of their own shuffling. Red dust went in their wide-open nostrils and stuck to their squeeze-box lungs. Red dust, working its devilment, he observed to himself, but he shut his mouth. They were not his horses. Medicine Ed led his own horse around the corner of the shed row. What was the name of this animal? If he had heard it, Medicine Ed didn't recall. It was a big red three-year-old, dumb as dirt, who Zeno had vanned up for the fourth race, a maiden without a scratch on him. A van ride on race day did for many a horse, but this boy had rolled out the van as calm as that puddle yonder, for he felt good and didn't know nothing. True, he had no class. He was the throwaway kind, a heavy head sprinter who looked like a quarter horse with a chest like a car radiator. He must not know what was coming, for once he was sure he might last to age 5, with luck. How long would Medicine Ed last? He had been on the racetrack since he was 8. After 64 years of this racetrack life, he too was sore and tired, and like the boll weevil in the song, he was looking for a home. He knew he would always have work as long as he could work. But where was it wrote that he had to rub horses till the day he died? And as for the medicine he could do, and which long ago gave him his name, best folks forgot about that. And in these parts, so far, they had. Up ahead was Sally Cruikshank, walking Grizzly, her moneymaker. Grizzly was the opposite end of the mound, a used-up stakes horse, a miler, nerved in half his feet, who knew everything. Medicine Ed liked to tell Sally, "Why you don't give that boy his rest? How old Grizzly be by now, 14? 15? He's 12, Sally always said, and he don't need no rest. Grizzly knows what comes next for him in this world. After me, I mean. He likes things the way they are. I bet you done told him, you hard-nosed old half-man. That's right. I told him. He'd rather run. She called back to Ed now. You got something in tonight? Zeno, ship up this big 3-year-old for the 4th. Give him a race. They went their two ways with their night and day cheap horses, and suddenly they were holding the two of them like kites. It had come one of them death squawks from an automobile spring, which you heard when some ignorant individual attempted to bust into the backside of Indian Mound Downs by the back gate. The four horses still on the hot walking machine taken off, galloping foolishly in the pink cloud around the pole like they did on any excuse. It was a dirt-caked and crumpled white Pontiac Grand Prix, 10 years old, longer and lower than it ought to be, resembling a flattened shoebox, with its front bumper hanging down on one side. A girl was driving it, a stranger girl, with round blind man sunglasses and two fat brown pigtails sticking out frizzly from her small head. She must have hit that puddle flying, since the Grand Prix bounced right out again. Red clay water squirted on all sides, like cream of tomato soup. The stall man, Suitcase Smithers, stepped out of the racing secretary's shack, brushing donut crumbs off the soft bag of guts that pushed out his lime pastel short-sleeved shirt and gray striped suspenders. He was an unhealthy-looking man of a drained cement color, and in that aggravating way he had of never looking straight at nobody, he said past, not into, the open window of the Pontiac, "What is your business on this racetrack, miss?" "I would like to talk to the stall superintendent, Mr. Vernon Smithers," said the girl. "Are you him?" He was him. She said, like they always said, that she worked for a horseman from Charlestown, or could have been Laurel or Pocono Downs. He was on the road right now with 3, 4, 5 horses. She come ahead to get the stalls ready. Suitcase read her the sign that hung over the back gate. Race track business, use front gate only. She stood there. Dusty sweat was gluing together her eyebrows. She wiped across them with the fat part of her hand. "Talk to Archie in the green uniform," said Suitcase, nodding at the faraway gatehouse. "I talked to Archie in the green uniform." "Well, I'm going to tell you the same as Archie told you." Suitcase cleared his throat. "I got no stalls." "Tommy Hansel called ahead," she said, like they always said. Her frizzly, dirt-brown pigtail stuck out another inch. "Henry who?" Suitcase said. "You don't walk in a busy race meeting and say, 'Give me 5 stalls. She said they give up 5 stalls in the old place for 5 stalls in this new place. Suitcase shrugged. "A van don't always show up on time," he explained. "Horsemen stay longer than they said. Horses get sick. Everything don't always go exactly on schedule." The girl stood there. She felt through her jeans pocket front and back and showed Suitcase down in her palm a pitiful little roll of bills. "Green as grass," Sal muttered. Medicine Ed felt her falling in love already. Suitcase Smithers shook his head but smiled down forgivingly. "Your money ain't long enough to buy 5 stalls next to each other in this dump, girlie," Sally commented. "First they scatter you all around the place, see what you got. Check it all out while you ain't looking, lessen you got 9 eyes. "That's enough now, you old newsbag," Suitcase barked, and the girl jumped. Sally laughed so her saggy old breasts barged around in her man's white tank top undershirt. Suitcase smiled at everybody to show he wasn't really angry. "Sally, why are you trying to alarm this young lady? Come in the office, miss. Let me see what I can find for you." They stood watching as Suitcase led the girl down the packed clay alley between the shed rows. "She'll take anything now," Sally said. "She pushed her way in the back gate, all right," Ed said, when Archie hung her up at the front. "She's doing it all for some handsome deadbeat horseman who works her to death while he rolls high. I seen a million like her," Sally said. "Ain't you the hard shell? Tomorrow you be nussering and petting her your own self." Medicine Ed left Zeno's 3-year-old in the stall, then looked back at him again from the Winnebago, for the door of the trailer was hanging wide open, and this raised the question why Zeno would hang around to bring the animal to post himself if the red horse was as no count as he appeared to be, and which Zeno said he was. And for that matter, why had Zeno drove the van up himself, the van with just the one horse in it? Medicine Ed was on the watch, for Medicine Ed, like the boll weevil in the song, was looking for a home. He had seen the clabbered cobwebs hanging down in the roof joints, though fall was far from here. He had seen a sparrow with blood-red wings. It was taking a dust bath, and when Medicine Ed walked by with the horse, the sparrow looked up and asked him a question in a language he could almost understand. They were signs that the thread that held it all together was rotting, letting loose and falling apart. He had a funny, goofered feeling about the way things was going, although Zeno treated him well. Medicine Ed would be 73 on Labor Day. Since he gave up drinking, he never even had a cold no more. Breathing that pine tar and horse manure all the day was a kind of devil tonic. On account of his froze-up left leg, the result of being run over by a big mare named High Soprano at Agua Caliente in 1958, he had to lie down in the straw on one hip, like a hoe posing for a nasty picture when he worked on a horse's feet. He had to lie on his good side and stick his bad leg straight out. But there wasn't anything a groom or either a trainer did that Medicine Ed could not still do. And Zeno, for all he was chubby fat and getting fatter, was a horseman of the old school, a gentleman who never forgot to dip down and stake you when he win. He was more ashamed to be stingy than to be broke, so that as long as he had $2, you had one, whereas a lot of them anymore, so tight, they scream, they so tight. Best of all, Zeno left Medicine Ed to run this little side operation here at Indian Mounds all by himself. He trusted Ed to medicate as right he should. Behind a loosened wall plate in the crumpled end of the trailer, Medicine Ed kept Zeno's doctor bag of ampules and syringes. The blue ampule was butazolidin. If you missed the vein with it, the horse would have a goiter hanging off his neck for 3 days, and he was a scratch. The red ampule was ACTH. Medicine Ed could easily have read those letters, if that's what was wrote there, but instead a name as long as your arm wrapped around the little bottle. It was some kind of tropical harmony for all hormones he had learned have to do with the lost harmony. Electrolytes came in a little blue and silver sack like a lunch bag of potato chips. The aspirin pills were loose in the bottom of the bag, white and as big around as a quarter. Oral Butte was white too, but longer and squared off, like little rowboats. Buca leaves brought forth piss. The Asmodor mix, smoldered under a horse's nose, drew long, glistening ropes of mucus from his sinuses. But butazolidin was the fast luck oil round here, Butte, the horseman's vitamin B. Generally, Medicine Ed carried a horse to the post and saddled it himself. Zeno stayed at Charlestown, sent somebody over with a couple horses every week or so when he saw spots for them, and vanned the used ones away. Zeno kept just the 4 stalls at the mound, one for a tack room, half solid with bales of hay and straw from the cobwebby rafters down to the dirt floor. And many a cheap tracker at the fairs in the old days, Medicine Ed would have found himself propping 2 bent old lawn chairs together in the tack room to sleep on. But Zeno had got him leave to haul in that half-caved-in Winnebago, which a tree fell over on it once when it was still in the trailer park in Charlestown, and which by far wasn't the worst place Medicine Ed ever laid his head. He could look out the window from his bunk in the afternoon and see all 3 of his horses at once, nosing hay around their stalls. The toilet wasn't hooked up, and nobody who had right judgment would open the shower curtain and look in. But 2 burners on the propane stove worked, and behind was a tidy cabinet in which Medicine Ed kept his soups and powders and other ingredients and preparations. He turned on his head a can of cream of mushroom in a pan, propped his stiff leg on the bunk, and stared at the slimy silo of soup while it melted. Zeno's fat back was hunched over the pink and black tic-tac-toe counter of the dinette. He huffed and puffed like he never stopped doing, and meanwhile he was crushing a glowing white pebble into a fine powder with the back of a kitchen knife. When he got that all up in his nose, he turned to Medicine Ed and instructed him in his cooking. "You ought to put some food in that food," he panted, "some milk or vegetables or something. I never see you eat nothing but that mung which housewives use it to mix with something else. You ain't 18 no more, Ed. Ought to think about them bones." My friend, the late Charles Philpott," Medicine Ed said slowly. "You remember Charles Philpott?" "Sure, I remember Charlie. He used to work for the Ogdens. Rubbed Equinox when he won the Preakness. I forget how he ended up at the mound. Charles Philpott was 85 years of age when they carried him out that gate. I thought the gaffer was 120, much as he claimed to know," said Zeno, popping open a cream soda. "Where'd they bury him anyhow?" "Sent him in a box on the train to South Carolina. His people wanted him back after all them years." "Maybe he sent him money regular," said Zeno. Medicine Ed was silent, except for the spoon clinking around the pan. "Say, Ed," Zeno said, "you see a funny-looking couple from Charlestown ship in here today, looking to steal a race or two with 4 horses? Tommy Hansel. Eyes like a royal nutcase. Decent horseman, though. I smoked dope with them a few times. Girl with hair out to here. You give him a hand if they need it. If I know him, suitcase stiffs him." Medicine Ed considered the thing. He hadn't taken to that frizzly hair girl, but Zeno moved right on. "So what about Charlie Philpott? What was his secret? Because I got to go look at a horse. What did he eat? I know you ain't going to tell me mushroom soup." "Charles never ate much of nothing. He had that little check from the Social Security every month, and I mean little. First thing he'd do, he'd take and buy him 3 cartons of Camel cigarettes. He smoked those camels till he died. Zeno laughed, stopping on his way out the doorway. So what did kill Charlie? One of his bets came in? He used to have no luck at all, except for knowing the Ogdens. I don't know, maybe you're right. The track finally let him have one of them new rooms over the kitchen. On the Ogdens, say so. Trying to do right by him after 30 years. First night in there, he keeled over. But Zeno was gone. His pickup truck, just a spurt of gravel, cloud of red dust. That was Zeno, excited, wheezing, out of breath, whistles leaking out his nose that ought not to be there, probably from sniffing that stuff. Fat Zeno busting through doors, squeezing into payphones, running around, dealing off this one, lining up that one, no rest, and a little fatter every week. You could see it sticking to him. And now he was off again, without telling Medicine Ed whether he should and ought to ride $10 on that big red maiden in the fourth race. Zeno had left his telegraph on the counter, and Medicine Ed opened to Indian Mound Downs, counted down four races, and tried to make something out. He didn't try to read all the words in the chart or the horses' names. Time was short, and that was beyond his learning. Z-E-N-O, he found readily enough. Over on the owner's side, to his surprise, he saw the same thing again. Owner, Zeno, G2. Then he looked at the numbers. Numbers he could read as good as Einstein. The thing that struck him right away about Zeno's three-year-old was the fewness of the numbers. For some reason, they had shut the fellow down after two races as a two-year-old. He was somebody's big red secret, for the horse had hardly run. The frizzly-haired girl landed up in one stall in Barn Z, that next-to-last stall ruinated by a deep ditch around the walls that some thousand-pound stall walker had dug on his endless round trips. It had taken muscle to shovel over enough dirt to fill that up, but she made it halfway right. He'd give her that. Psst, Sally leaned around the corner of the stall and crooked her finger at the girl. You running anything in the next few days? It was a long pause. Then, I don't think so, she'd say, and Medicine Ed watched the frizzly-haired girl try to empty her face. In the lying capital of the world, she would have to do better than that. Well, if you do run something, and you don't want to let him out your sight, Sally said, which I wouldn't if I was you, put him in the stall here and ask Medicine Ed to let you sleep in Zeno's tack room. He lets me. She winked. It was a dreadful thing to see. And the frizzly hair girl backed off from her. Calm down, girlie. I don't mean you and me. I sleep in the stall with my moneymaker, Grizzly. He appreciates me, she cackled. That tack room you see got a chink in the east wall. You can lay on hay bales and look through the chink and watch a horse all night if you can hold your eyes open. Talk to Medicine Ed, that's him. And she pointed to where he was, standing in the dirt road with the red horse and kid stuff, the blacksmith. Medicine Ed saw the frizzly hair girl's eyes light, not on him, but on the blacksmith. Ha! It happened every time. Kid stuff was a pretty little man, chestnut brown, with a tilted smile and very white teeth, out of Louisiana, part Creole, part Huma Indian, like as not. The girl tiptoed up. She said, excuse me. You end up with stalls in this barn, young lady? One, she said. Suitcase scatter they horses all over the ground, Medicine Ed told kid stuff. Ah, don't take it personal, the blacksmith advised. It's the 10-cent Hitlers run this place. They like to break your spirit before you ever get to a race. Who you with? Tommy Hansel. The horseshoer looked quizzically at Medicine Ed. They shook their heads politely. She needs a place to sack out for the night, Sally hollered over. Can she get in your tack room, Ed? Medicine Ed shrugged. Ain't nothing in it, he said. Hey, welcome to it. The farrier put away his tools. Zeno gonna let this boy run tonight, he asked. Mike could figure, Medicine Ed said, what he always said, if he don't come up lame. So where did Zeno pick up this Mr. Bullweevil? I seen the sire before, but who's this high cotton? Talk about breeders you never heard of. Sunk Ferry, Arkansas. The old groom stumbled back as though he had been struck. What you talking about, Mr. Bullweevil? This horse you're holding right here, and tonight for $12.50, maiden claimer, fourth race. Say, here's Tommy Hansel, the blacksmith said to the girl. This your guy? May I see that paper, please? The frizzly girl said faintly. She looked in the telegraph where kid stuff was pointing, and out of her mouth come a terrible cuss word, not quite under her breath. Medicine Ed blinked at her. For a little while, time went backwards for her, the same as for him. Then he piled the shank right on top of that paper and backed away. His long, ash-brown fingers shook. He appeared to be buckling, fading, got smaller and smaller in the direction of the half-crushed mobile home he lived in. He held a hand over his heart as he staggered backwards like an actor in a play. His mouth was a ragged hole. No word came out. Now they saw the gray stumps of his gums. The blacksmith was shaken. "Damn me," he said. "Damn me. Maybe he needs the doc. Hey, Ed, you all right?" he yelled after him. The door of the bashed-in trailer clicked shut. "I've seen these old-timers pitch over dead more than once," he said to the girl shyly, now that they were alone. "You never know." "I think it was something about that horse," she wondered. And that was that. A cool green light came on in the blacksmith's eyes. His handsome lips quivered like a rabbit's, smelling something. Then he slightly smiled. He looked back at the trailer. Already the tall old groom was returning to them, limping across the dirt alleyway with a calm grimace. He had even remembered to put in his teeth. Then they were all in on it. If the old man wasn't dying, it came down to a flash about a horse. There was no need for studying and dreaming. Often in the past of medicine, Ed needed to know about a horse. He could sit over a hand made of tail and mane hairs of the horse and tied with a red string and hoof shaving and one green corner bit of his lucky money, push them around in hot candle sperm with a hoof pick under the light of the same white candle, and dream until the answer came to him. But today was no need, no time. Soon as he heard the name of the horse Zeno was running, he knew what he must do. He must ride his lucky money on Mr. Woolweevil, who had beckoned to him. And somehow he felt he had to touch his lucky money just then. There it is. Never mind if it looks strange. He stumbled into the trailer. It was a 50 Zeno gave him last year when they stole a nice little race in the Poconos with Do It Again. He kept it pressed flat and neat between the lid and the waxed cardboard seal of a pickle jar of hedge beech leaf. The bill was evenly folded four times, so Ulysses S. Grant looked up thoughtful at you out of the lower left-hand corner. It was no use wishing it was 100 or a couple of hundreds. He'd seen better years than them with Zeno, and worse years. Thing of it was, he had lucky money. Like the Bullweevil, he was looking for a home, and here was Mr. Bullweevil in the fourth slot in the fourth race, beckoning to him. It was not a harming goofer that Medicine Ed knew the makings of. This ghost gray powder had never been meant to undo a horse. It was a root work of strong encouragement, of reaching deep into the lost harmony and milking up one drop of what was needed at the last. The gray rolled leaf, which stuck to itself like cobweb, came from a hedge beech in Hope on Earth, COGIC Churchyard in Vaucluse, South Carolina. The tree grew sidewise out of the grave of his grandfather, Eduardo Pickett's, greatest jockey ever known in South Carolina, born in slavery, killed in a match race in 1888. It sprung out of the grave dirt, twisted in the shape of a man riding, with one straight limb shooting out of it like a whip, and its leaves must be collected at dark of moon from that limb only. This jar was dried heartleaf. This one was horse mushroom. This here was boneset. The fine gray-gold sugar with specks of black peat in it was sand and shatters from the infield of Major Longstreet Park and that little arc of elderberry bush where Cannonball was buried. And finally, he had needed blood of great speed. And what he got must have been good enough. It was the blood of Platonic, who he had rubbed for Whirligig Farm and who gave him his own bleeding ulcer. Platonic had scratched his fetlock in the gate the day he won the seashell, and Ed had scrooched down before he gave the horse his bath and scraped every black flake into this little bottle here. And that, once he mixed it to his recipe, was Medicine Ed's horse goofer dust. But he had give up doctoring. Come to find out, if you asked by powerful means for more than the animal had to give, you could not manage the results. Every time he had cast the powder, the horse had won, but won for the last time. Some way, that was the last race of the horse, at least the last he ever saw. Either way, he was all done, like Willie W., who was nerved and hooked a front sticker on his behind foot and ripped out his frog and had to be put down. Or Scraggly Lake, who bled for the third time and was banned and auctioned, and he never saw him again. Or Three Spot, the onliest horse Medicine Ed ever loved, who went for him at Hollywood Park and snapped her cannon bone in the van on the short drive home, and which was why he had let the medicine go, all except his name, which nobody up here was wise to where it come from. And that was a good thing. Fact was, after that first time with Willie W., he had had to need the money extremely bad. At Santa Anita, he bought himself a change of address fast, behind, what was her name, Estelle, his pachuco boyfriend, come looking for him with a knife. After three spot, he vowed never to touch the horse goofer again. This was in 1955. But now the peculiar harmony of Mr. Bollweevil running in the fourth race had beckoned to him. He was 72 years old and tired. He never paid no mind to horses' names, disremembered most of them. This one sneaked up on him. He's looking for a home. He's looking for a home. Must be some kind of home out there looking for him, Medicine Ed. He had done for horses all his life. If he had spent his working days in one place with just one stable like Charles Philpott, maybe they would give him a tack room in the end, or even a room to himself over the track kitchen, and let him fade. He would turn into one of them old pops who get up at 4 a.m. to the day they die and limp to the track and run errands for folks, get ice and coffee and such. But as a young man, he'd been restless. If somebody's girlfriend caught his eye, he was heedless. In the old days, he'd get to drinking, get to fighting. Then worry over platonic gave him that ulcer which put him in Sinai Hospital and damn near killed him, afraid to make a mistake, afraid something gone happened to the horse before he get him to his race, study and worry all the time. And after I win the seashell, what they give me, there it is, damn gold watch. He was bad sick when he worked on platonic. It was only that jealous pachuco boyfriend with a knife who got him out of that, the time he used the goofer with three spot. He cashed his bet and went down to Tijuana for 2 years, got him a room over a dentist shop, and didn't miss no racetrack either. Not one bit. Except for what happened to his filly, he used to think sometimes he ought to find that crazy Mexican and thank him. Down Tijuana, that was when he got his teeth. He had plenty of time to get fitted downstairs for a nice set of teeth until his cash run down. Bad teeth could kill you, slowly poison your blood, ruinate the other organs. Now he had the good teeth and no home. Maybe if he hadn't got his teeth, but he had. If he had cause to think death would take him fast when it came, like Charles Philpott. But last time he seen the doc, it was for a tetanus shot after some horse shipped up from Florida, jumped out the stall and bit him, and Zeno made him go. The doc said his heart and lungs were 20 years younger than he was. If he hadn't give up drinking after that ulcer, but after he got out the hospital, he couldn't look at the stuff no more. And then he forgot about drinking. Found he grew ponderful in the evenings on his own anymore. Didn't need no liquor, no nothing. He had deep thoughts. He had no learning, no way to write his thoughts. But this was his own fault. If he hadn't run away to his Uncle Wilbur at the races at the age of 8, so his other family was lost to him, on his father's side, a good many were educated, teachers and barbers and such. After his mother died, he could have gone to her people in Arkansas. But they were Christian path folk, farmed cotton on shares, and didn't want nothing to do with racehorses. Looking for a home at the age of 72. It was his own damn fault. He could feel bitter about certain things. After he win the seashell stakes, a $225,000 race, a gold watch that stopped the first year. But some way he was lucky. He could see something in the whirling dust, the shadows. The harmony showed itself to him. It made strong suggestions to him as to why things were the way they were. But this was the onliest time it had told him in words what to do, Mr. Bollweevil. He put the 50 back for now and screwed the lid on tight, and as he walked out of the trailer to collect his abandoned mare from the frizzly-haired girl in the blacksmith, he caught his brown, sunken face under its pad of white hair in the shaving mirror over the kitchen sink. Even in his hurriment, it stopped him. How it seemed to quiver and heave, and then all at once to crack open, not like a death mask, but like a woman's beauty mask which a newborn face is just coming out of. In the same moment, he remembered to reach in the glass on the counter and slip in his teeth. Outside, it was a young lady present. This was always a good sign. The frizzly-haired girl wasn't watchful like Sally had told her. Thus and consequently, it was easy for Medicine Ed to be watchful. He went in his tack room and put his eye up on that chink and taken a deep look at them, the funny-looking couple from Charlestown, dope-smoking friends of Zeno, Tommy Hansel and the frizzly-haired girl, and their big red horse. It was a peculiar thing how Zeno's horse and this young fool showed up today like might could be twin brothers. Common enough horses, but like seeing double. Both maidens, both geldings, fat, red, without a mark on them, not even a white sock, and both the color of store-bought whiskey. As for Tommy Hansel, what was the story on that young fellow? It had Medicine Ed wool gathered, trying to fit him in where he belonged. He was a racetracker in his moves, but he wasn't a racetracker in his face. He had a Jordan John look about him which gave Medicine Ed the creeper crawlers. Wide forehead, black curly beard, high color for a white man, and burning
eyes.
Big, black, jewelry eyes. This business will run men crazy, Zeno always say. The young fool had a crazy look about him. He had a wild man's laugh. It gave Medicine Ed the creeper crawlers down to the bottom of his hair, and he could not understand why Mr. Bullweevil should have a look-alike in that man's company. I don't get why we had to come here, Tommy, the frizzly-haired girl say to him. It's all crooks running this place. And he said, hey, maybe they got no stalls. And he laughed that laugh. What do you mean, she said. I saw empty stalls all over this dump. I saw three in this barn alone, all a lot better than this one. Maybe they think I'm a nobody, he said with a king-size smile. Not like he really thinks he is a nobody. This old gyp Sally Cruikshank says they want to get a look at what we have. Let them look. What can they tell from looking? Everything we got's beat up, bowed, got a knee, a foot, a sesamoid, something. The worse they look half the time, the better they run. Yeah? What about this one, she said, and together they looked at the fat red horse. Young fool's voice dropped way down. That's different, he whispered. Not a mark on him. That's why I'm not waiting till somebody sees. She fetched the pitchfork, poked up a mat of dark piss straw, and carried it to the front of the stall on the flat of the tines. When? She said. Tonight. You really put him in? While I can. You're not going to scratch? Nope. Right out of the van? Correct. With Jojo Wood riding him? Jojo just has to turn him loose. And he's in for 6 furlongs, she said. You never send him more than 5. We have a very good shot in this race, the young fool said. We didn't leave our home to take a shot, Tommy. What's wrong with you? Young fool ain't answer, and she went stomping out the stall in her bargain basement sneakers. He had on $100 horseman shoes from London, England, color of new pennies, with zippers up the back. She was back directly with her own paper. Gassino's got a horse in this race. That's right. I think he might be gambling on that horse. No way, the young fool said. It's a nothing horse, big red baby, hardly been out, and he's giving it a race. He looks just like our horse, the frizzly girl said. I saw him myself. To the ignorant, our horse might look like a nothing horse, but Zeno's horse is a nothing horse, as he'd be the first to tell you. Let me see that paper. He snapped it flat in his hand so loud that the red horse threw his head up and screamed a little, and the young fool glared over the quarter-folded telegraph at the girl. It's a nothing horse, he repeated after a moment. He threw the paper at her feet, and she picked it up, turned her back on him, and studied it. Zeno's horse always goes 6 furlongs, the frizzly girl said. He snatched her off the ground by the cuffs of her jeans, and she fell on her belly in the straw. And then he picked her up by her rear waistband and pushed her against the wall. He was no pygmy racetracker. He was a well-grown man. You shut up. You hear me, he said. Let me go, she said. Someone might come by. Just shut up. Do you hear me? You understand? What do you want? She whispered. I want you to capitulate. All right. All right, she said. The young fool went off somewhere, and now, like Sally said, she don't let the animal out of her eyesight. She sat in the straw memorizing the horse, with her hands wrapped around her bony knees and her back against the wall. It wasn't all that much to see. She looked at his clean red legs, at the long tendons where they rolled in and out each other as he moved his weight, like strings on a bass fiddle. For a horse going to a race in 60 minutes, he ain't have much to say for himself, just standing in a tub of ice, staring in the dark, like his twin, Mr. Bullweevil, standing in a tub of ice across the way. Then they were walking to the track, the girl leading the one red horse, Medicine Ed leading the other, Mr. Boll Weevil, on a short shank a few lengths back. The tall old groom dragged his right leg lightly through the gravel, mumbling some old song to himself or the horse. It was a maiden race for a cheap price, and these two horses, though you could not tell them apart, stood well out from the other horses. Both were chunky and solid, both the red of weather-beaten fire hydrants, with big square chests and a heavy, easy way of going. The others, they were shufflers with their heads hanging down like plow animals, or tremblers, or rearers, their scared penises battened out of sight in purses of loose gray skin, underbellies awash in yellow foam. Zeno came out of the clubhouse to saddle the horse, his red cheeks huge, his pop eyes shining. What could it mean save that Zeno had been to the windows, getting down heavy on his own horse? The young fool and the frizzly-haired girl were standing at the walking ring when suddenly they saw him. They whispered to each other, "Gotta, where did he come from, look?" And Medicine Ed, watching from under the clubhouse overhang, noted they ain't that glad to see him. Now the twin horses went off on toe points one by one to the track, green silks on one, purple on the other, and Zeno, whether his company was desired or not, smiling like a man giving a banquet, joined Hansel at the rail. Gus Zeno, who was born in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, liked to dress like a rich rancher. He wore a string tie and a silver belt buckle on which was tooled G bar Z between a pair of longhorn skulls. The buckle bit deep into his belly. His cord-piped, light blue jacket bunched poor boy style under his arms. Next to this finery, the coiled leather shank in his hand looked small and plain. "All bums except our two," Zeno panted to Hansel. "It's a match race." "And one of them must be a bum too," Hansel said, smiling. And then he stopped smiling. He was looking at the coiled up shank in Zeno's hand. It was an ordinary, indifferently cared for piece of tack, used for leading a horse anywhere, anytime. Medicine Ed was standing under the clubhouse overhang some way off, holding another shank just like it. No racehorse needs two shanks. "God damn it, Zeno," Hansel said. "You bought my horse." "He's a very, very good horse for the money," Zeno said. "But you know, Tommy, I like my horse in this race. Sure, he's a bum, but the price is right, and he likes the distance." "Damn it," Hansel said. "Damn it to hell." He didn't raise his voice, but his eyes were wild. He was pacing up and down the gap, looking at Zeno as if there might be some hole in the deal, some clause or sleight of hand he hadn't thought of yet. But then he burst out, raggedly laughing. "Hey, Tommy, this business will run you crazy," Zeno said, slapping him on the back. They stood there together with their backs to the clubhouse, looking at the tote board. Under the clubhouse overhang, Medicine Ed, too, looked at the tote board. The two horses kept trading back and forth, 5-1, 6-1, 5-1. Praise Jesus, the folks with the money liked another horse entirely. The frizzly-haired girl flew in her holy sneakers up into the grandstand. The young fool didn't even see her go. 2 minutes to post, and the young fool and Medicine Ed hit the windows at the same time. From his eye corner, Medicine Ed couldn't see to the $50 window exactly how much come off that roll. But the young fool was in for a bundle. The old groom was fading away down the center stair to the lower deck when the young fool taken him by the shoulder. "I like the way you handle horses," he says. "Whatever Zeno pays you, I'll add a dime to that. My woman, you saw her. She's strong as a horse," but he smiled. "I need an experienced hand." "I done work for Mr. Zeno 8 years now," Medicine Ed said, "and he has been good to me." "You think about it," the young fool say, and Medicine Ed say, "I think about it." What he don't say, "I have heard that run crazy laugh. I seen you throw the frizzly girl on the floor. In the name of the Holy Ghost, let this man go back where he come from. Let him take away that devil he's carrying and keep me wide of a boss such as that." For he liked the frizzly-haired girl a little better now. Old Sally had spied into the heart of this young woman and seen their slavery of the man-woman kind. Medicine Ed could see the chains on the girl. They were thick and heavy as railroad couplings, but they lay in a loose necklace around her neck and shoulders. She was no little bitty, silky thing. The weight of them chains had raised muscles on her. She had a long bird neck with strong cords in it and square shoulders. And Medicine Ed saw this. While the young fool ain't looking, Suddenly he had something else, probably the money he fixing to lose, on his mind. The frizzly-haired girl lifted the heavy chains off her shoulders like a daisy chain and laid them down again. She stepped off from the place where the young fool thought she was and ran away on goofered feet up into the clubhouse, gone to play some other horse than the master play. She was a slave, but she had the power to ride the grandstand just like the master do, if she see her chance. Gates clang open, and Mr. Bollweevil, he is looking for a home, all right. He's still looking around that gate like he's thinking about putting up wallpaper in it, making a down payment on a living room suite, moving in for life. Finally drops his heavy head, and it soaks in that all them other horses have done already gone and left him behind. He takes off running, passing horses right and left, and you can see he ain't half trying yet. He just eats holes for himself between them other animals in his weevily way. But the young fool's red horse has long since flew to the rail, and all Ed can see is the dusty thunder under his red behind, barreling around the clubhouse turn. Then Medicine Ed blinks his eyes, and he is into the back stretch. The horse has some speed. Jesus, take me home. That horse be at the half-mile pole already, heading into the far turn, and he is 5 lengths in front, going on 6, by the time Mr. Bollweevil comes creeping. If this keeps up, Medicine Ed is gone to lose his lucky money, never mind how much goofer powder he has thrown. Meanwhile, Mr. Bollweevil has steadily climbed up the rest of the racetrack in his sideways, frontways, weevily way. He passes all the rest of the pack, but he's still running in the red dust of the young fool's horse. He ain't gaining on him, just hanging 4-5 lengths behind him, and the young fool's horse looks like loping out there, jogging down the meadow for a morning look around. And then it's like Medicine Ed has called the race. The young fool's horse does just that. He looks around. He pulls up at the head of the stretch, drifts out from the rail, maybe eyeballing all the white paper flapping in the grandstand, which is all them people looking at their cards, trying to make out who that two horse is. What is the matter with that boy on his back? Well, now he comes to life, busting on the horse. But Mr. Bollweevil has crawled up on the inside in his weevily way, eats along the rail, gets his ugly red nose in first. Medicine Ed and Zeno pass the young fool in the gap on their way to the infield. Hansel has a torn-in-half look in his burning eye, like he aspires to be free-hearted and to exult with Zeno, but he ain't able. Well, Zeno, that's the last time a nothing horse beats one man band, he hollers. I ain't worried, Zeno says, and they shake hands. The frizzly girl has slipped away to cash her tickets. Medicine Ed sees the young fool's hands are trembling. When they got to the winner's circle, it was just the two of them. Soon as the young fool was out of sight, Zeno blew it out his top like a factory whistle, so only Medicine Ed could hear. Jeez, peasy Ed, I got us a live one this time. Did you see the way that horse run? Sure is, he paid pretty good, too. I think he'd gone off a little on his right behind foot. Medicine Ed craned up on his good leg, gazed at the hot horse that the jockey was jogging back to them. He wanted to set Zeno down gently, let him know he won't have this horse much longer. Not this one man? Bollweevil ain't shit. I mean one man band, Hansel's horse, the one I claimed. Zeno shook the extra shank at him. The one I claimed. How had he missed it? Zeno never said a word in front to nobody when he was fixing to take a horse. But generally, Medicine Ed would see it coming. Mr. Bollweevil had blinded his eye. Now fierce dread fingered him in the back of his neck, for he recognized the confusing and riddlesome power of the gray-green goofer dust. You know it can't change your luck, there it is. But what it will change into, that you cannot know. You're going down and get him for me in a minute, soon as Rembrandt here gets his camera loaded. The track photographer was fussing with his plates. Treat him like Kelso, you hear? He ran a half mile in under 45, and if there'd been a jock on his back instead of a sofa, he would have kept on running at the 16th pole. He wasn't used up. He thought the goddamn race was over. The photographer was finally ready, and Gustino smiled tremendous into the camera. Medicine Ed smiled a little too, even with them icy fingers in the back of his neck. He was relieved Zeno didn't set too much store by his own horse. For solid as Mr. Bollweevil looked now, standing there blowing and sweating, Zeno was sure to lose him. Still, the horse had paid $13.30. Zeno had the red horse he had claimed and his own bet and the purse. and Medicine Ed could pay a little down on a trailer he knew about in Hallandale in the old lot for colored behind Major Longstreet Park. I already made my nut on Bull Weevil, Zeno preened. If he win one or two more on top of his maiden, that's gravy. But Tommy Hansel's horse, Ed, that one's a race. Ha, ha, ha. Gus Zeno got stuck on that word. He tried to wheeze his way around it. Ha, 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 ha. His lips peeled back and set in that wet red O, and his eyes bulged out of their dark rose rims. Medicine Ed leaned around to look down his throat. The flash drenched them in white, and Gussina was still stuck behind that word. Ho, ho. His happy face went plum color, then black. Medicine Ed saw what it was. Luck, a ho, if there ever was one, got her bony fingers in his throat and was pulling on that word. She wanted that word back. Zeno wasn't giving it up. He tried to go the other way, but she pulled and pulled. She pulled him flat over on his face. He was still kicking a little behind. You want your luck? There's your damn luck, she say. And he was dead. Medicine Ed looked up and saw the young fool, with his eyes like burnt-out stove coals, standing empty-handed in the gap. Then he saw himself in the time to come, hauling 5-gallon buckets for the young fool, bandaging ankles on his doomed horses, walking hots for him, waiting for the fall. That was when Medicine Ed finally heard what Mr. Bull Weevil had been trying to tell him. He's looking for a home. That was one way of singing that song. Gonna get your home. That was another. The goofer powder ain't all landed yet, and it wasn't this little win and its chunk of lucky money that Mr. Bull Weevil was singing to him about. It was the passing of Gus Zeno. And it wasn't a new home for Medicine Ed he was bragging on. No down payment on a little mobile home with a green stripe awning and a palm tree behind the track in Hallandale. It was the end of the good home he did have. It was goodbye to the easy life he knew now. Thank you. You all may be worn out, but if you have questions, I'm certainly willing to answer them.
Well, I do. I was just wondering, how is it you start writing? Do you know how a story's going to end before you start, or do you just start writing and let it write itself for that?
I sometimes start writing without knowing what I'm writing. That is, I think that... That's a good thing for a writer to be able to do, to just hear interesting words, to hear a musical phrase, to start playing with something overheard. But I think I'm too afraid of boring people and of writing. You know, I'm not a very prolific author, I must admit. I don't easily plunge ahead with an idea. It has to really seem terrific to me. With this story, this section of the novel, but let's say this, with trying to get a narrative that really interested me about this character, just for example, the idea came to me of an old groom who believed in hoodoo and had some kind of recipes for it, who was a root worker of a kind, but who had the art of making a horse win, but knowing then that he would lose the horse. When I got that idea, I thought, great, okay, now I know I can write this story. I kind of wrote this story around that idea. I just needed a sort of a narrative knot that had a feeling of... narrative momentum about it. I'm afraid I've gone past the point where I would be interested in anything less than that. Although, I mean, there are very good writers who proceed with more faith than I do. They get a small idea, and then they just listen for the voices, and it takes them to an interesting place, or a place they think is interesting enough. But I just don't ever trust that it will be interesting enough. So, but I don't need a whole lot. I just need I need some little nugget that also seems to be rolling some inevitable place. Then I can go. Are there other questions?
Can you tell us about your race track experience?
Sure. I hope that I can tell you a little bit. It was all on very cheap racetracks, as this might indicate. I was living in West Virginia, and although Maryland is very much, it's true that that most of my books have a Maryland base, there is a little corner of West Virginia very near Hagerstown and Frederick, Maryland, that has a, and actually had at the time that I'm writing about in the 70s, two racetracks, two very large racetracks that drained away all the horses that had just slid a little too far down in the money for Laurel, Liberty Bell, Pimlico, the big East Coast, Middle Atlantic racetracks. And that was actually a very competitive racetrack for a cheap racetrack, so that people in the know knew that horses that were coming from Charlestown that were shipping into another cheap racetrack would often be a cut above the horses that they were competing with, which is the scenario that I'm trying to suggest with Gazzino, shipping in a few horses from Charlestown. But this little racetrack, Indian Mound Downs, is based on a real, I mean, there were cheap racetracks, and then there was the cheapest. That was Waterford Park on the Ohio River, very close to Martinsville and Steubenville, Ohio, and Wheeling. And that was the most notorious. I mean, where everybody else had the cheapest race at $1,500, the Waterford Park, you could even go to $1,250. And that's the kind of racetrack that I'm trying to portray with this novel. What else can I tell you? Well, I worked for a groom, like the frizzly hair girl does, and I loved being on the racetrack, although I certainly had the feeling of being an outsider there. I would never have expected to end up working on the racetrack. I just worked at every business that was available in that county of the adjacent counties of Maryland and West Virginia, where I ended up living, very close to Harper's Ferry. In fact, even the frizzly girl is, when she first meets the horse trainer that she's working for the Frederick News Post, writing food copy, which is something else that I did, and gets drawn into this racetrack life. As for the grooms, those old-timey black grooms who were commoner on the racetrack then than they are now were, to me, the most fascinating characters because they were extremely well-educated in what they did. I mean, they were really the most valuable kind of help that anybody could have. But they had no protection. It was very striking to me what the ends of their lives must look like to them. A little later, some social insurance was put into place for these people, but not at that time, which was in the 70s. So that's what I'm writing about. And there's still, I mean, there's certainly, there are not many, but there's still a few characters like this around on the racetrack. And some of them still don't have the protection of a permanent job. So it's very heartbreaking to see somebody whose body is really crippled by this very hard work, for whom you can't imagine any comfortable old age. Do you have any other questions about it? I mean, lead me on. I'll answer any question that you have. I should say this. Although I felt like a stranger on the racetrack, I do come from a line of gamblers on my mother's side, and I knew that my Uncle Willie had a racetrack background. I also knew that he had, to put it euphemistically, a kind of a finance business of a sort. But I had no idea until I met Bubbles Riley, who knew him at Pimlico, just exactly what level of tout and gambler he was at that racetrack. And I found out a lot about him to my shock. I mean, I did know that he was worth enough to somebody to murder him. When he was in his 80s, he was murdered and stuffed into a garbage bag and left in a field. So somebody was very angry with him. But if I say it without emotion and I seem cold, I didn't know him very well, but I knew about him from my mother. So I was surprised to find that that I came by this more honestly than I thought in my genes. And actually, I write about that in the novel. More Than Ever Happened to Me While I Was Working at the Racetrack. It turns out that this girl and Tutai are related, and Tutai knows it, but she doesn't. And he starts trying to help her, and that's his own downfall in the book. So, yes.
How did you end up working at an odd job?
Doesn't every writer work with odd jobs? You know, I tell my students, my graduate students in this writing program now, that in one essential way, the world of writers and college is very different than from the way that it was when I was in school, and it's a scary way. That is that most of them are in debt by the time they get out of school in a way that I wasn't. I didn't feel that I had to work at permanent, serious jobs right away. And I wanted to be a writer. I hadn't published anything, and who knew if I ever would. But I didn't think that was so amazing for somebody in her 20s. I still have a hard time. If I hear about a really interesting job for which you need no education, I still get the urge to apply for it. For years, I was really feverishly interested in trying out new situations like that, especially since I could do it without any professional investment in. And even newspaper work, small-town newspaper work, for me was that way. I loved that job, writing food copy. Who would have thought, you know? I would have thought I would have resisted women's pages for all I was worth. But in fact, I love food, so maybe it wasn't so surprising. I loved writing recipes and things like that. But for the first 5 or 6 years when I got out of college, I never worked more than, I barely made a year on a job. And those are still the things I'm writing about. Those jobs, I suppose I should write an academic novel for all the years I've invested in working in a university now. There are quite a few out there, so maybe mine would not be needed. But the places that I keep returning to are the places that I worked in my 20s for material. Just seemed more like the real world than the university ever quite has to me. So, boy, in other words, I recommend it to my students. If they possibly can avoid working at a serious job, wait to go to graduate school. I tell my undergraduates, work at crummy jobs. It doesn't matter what. Do something until you're 25, 26. You'll be much more able to appreciate the respite and the haven of graduate school if you've done that, and you'll have material that you wouldn't have otherwise. And I mean, for better or worse, I did. That's what I did. But I can see that some students they're too scared about money when they get out now, and they can't tread water in that way. Are there other questions? Thank you all very much for patiently listening to that long, long story.